The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The second member of the Chicago School, as it was called, and one who had moved in a similar direction but new as well, was Lewis Worth. Lewis Worth attempted something that had not been tried before, a cultural definition of the city, and this was a new direction. Most defined the city in terms of physical property, aggregation, and density. In 1938, Lewis Worth wrote and published an essay, Urbanism as Urbanism as a Way of Life. Up until now, during the 10 years that followed Worth's work, Chicago sociologists produced a large quantity of mainly descriptive studies, focusing on different types of groups within the city. Worth systematized these insights into the first truly sociological theory of the city. That is, he emphasized the universal social characteristics of the city and then used earlier studies to support the implications these factors would have for determining the character of urban social life. Urbanism he defines as, quote, the forms of social action and organization that typically emerge in relatively permanent, complete settlements of large numbers of heterogeneous individuals. End of quote. A very heavy thing. But for our purposes, and in terms of his legacy to scholarship, three characteristics particularly emerged out of this definition that were given prominence. Three characteristics, as it were, that defined for Worth the city. Number one, population size. Number two, population density. And number three, social difference or heterogeneity. And Worth argued that these three characteristics resulted in the kinds of things that the Chicago School were then identifying with the city. And, by the way, things that I think a lot of people still do, both on a popular level and the theoreticians. Again, we'll comment on these results in just a minute. But first of all, let's take a look at some of the sampling. For example, what said Worth resulted from population size, the bigness of the city? Well, he said, increased diversity of cultural characteristics, increased diversity of occupational characteristics, that is, professional structure with advanced division of labor, increase in impersonal human relationships, segmentalized social life based on roles, he argued, rather than personal characteristics. You can sense the old debates in that kind of comment. City structure hardening into commercial enterprise, moral structure of the city loosening towards a state of enemy, and of course an intensification of the effects noted above. There was a second characteristic, population density. And Worth continued, this density results also in certain specific urban characteristics. Among them are these, he said, ecological specialization, the city as a mosaic, in other words, of differentiated land areas, districts reflecting productive specialties, devices to facilitate visual recognition, status symbols, unusual dress, increased toleration of differences, increased social distance, increased antisocial behavior, friction, irritation, and again, as before, an intensification of all of these effects. The third characteristic of the city, Wirth had argued, was heterogeneity. And this, he continued on, resulted as well in certain effects that he argued we see in cities. A sense of heightened mobility, fluctuating status, acceptance of insecurity and instability, increased physical relocation, increased use of stereotypes and categorical thinking, increased importance of money as the basis of social relations. Now, Wirth's theory would dominate the field for the next 20 years, which brings us up into the late 50s, early 60s. He used the main insights, I think you've already sensed, of the European tradition, but tied them to the method of participant observation that was the hallmark of the Chicago School. But I'm sure that also you may be sensing these theories had their problems, very similar, in fact, to the whole Chicago School. And I want to mention a couple of those problems, and we'll be brief. In the first place, the Chicago School continued to promote a rather negative view of the city. For Lewis Wirth, the city was an acid, he said, that in time would eat away traditional values, it would undermine the formation of meaningful institutions and relationships. Like Robert Park before him, he saw the possibilities of a greater freedom in the city, but he also worried that any such positive aspects would be compromised by disorganization, alienation, stereotypical characterizations, all these things, he said, that were bred in this city environment. Secondly, the Chicago School very narrowly limited its fieldwork to a particular kind of city, that is, obviously, to Chicago, a Western capitalist city that was moving at that point into very high-gear industrialization. And I think we need to recognize this limits their work. Really, in a sense, it's the same danger that we'd face right here in Philadelphia, teaching a course like urban anthropology. If we decided that we would, Philadelphia would sort of be our lab experiment in urbanization. Philadelphia is not Nairobi. Nairobi is not Addis Ababa. Addis Ababa isn't Seoul. The danger in focusing on one city, of course, is you can neglect the changes that this urbanization has seen in its history, and of course, particularly the changes in urbanization from a cross-cultural perspective. And I think those dangers were present in the Chicago School, sometimes still among evangelical writers. Thirdly, and again, focusing on problems here with the Chicago School, they concentrated in their field studies, it seems to me, on the what we call the seamy side of city life. So their very detailed and exciting studies, still valuable today, focused on things like slums, juvenile delinquency, organized crime, the taxi hall, the taxi dance hall, a hotel life, the professional thief, the hobo. And in doing all of this, though they left us with a rich heritage of study, that very study may have been too micro-dimensional to catch the macro-dimensional character of the city. And again, I think that's our danger here also. With a great deal of current interest, for example, in the poor and ethnic communities in the city, we are always standing sort of in the shadow of the possibility of misinterpreting the city where we go in the light of the city where we are. And that is a struggle, I think, that's still with us. Before we leave this whole area of the Chicago School and its impact, I want to also ask a few questions about church growth agenda considerations, as it were, based on that may or may not flow out of this kind of study. In other words, we're asking, hey, is the city a heaven or a hell? Is the city a place where the best will emerge, or where people will go bad? Now, the weight of this classic tradition of urban sociology, as I'm sure you know by now, is very heavily on the negative side, and I think it has deeply affected even evangelical thinking. Is this right? There is a classic study, beginning urban sociology, which is a very helpful one, by James Spates and his colleague Makionis. I'm not sure I've got the pronunciation right, Macionis. The book is called The Sociology of Cities, published in 82 by St. Martin's Press in New York. And in this book, Spates and Makionis discuss three of the agenda items raised by these classical theories. And what I'd like to do now is to talk about those three agenda issues, and particularly think of them in terms of their relation to church growth. First of all is the issue of tolerance in the city. Now, these theories we've been talking about presumed that the city provided a characteristic emphasis of tolerance in contrast to the parochialism of the village and the small town. And I think in general, and I underline general, subsequent research has concluded this contention is true. But at the same time, I think it's important, even as we acknowledge the generalization, to make several qualifications, and these are very important in terms of thinking of church and mission. First qualification, you can very easily overstate the case. For example, the residential patterns of most cities reveal, a la Park and Worth, certain areas of affluence where people presumably wish to distance themselves from the poor. Urbanites in general carve out their place in the city as they are attracted to or repelled from certain other people or places. That is to say, racial and ethnic tensions intensify in the city because of density factors. Now, what does this say about church growth? Well, I think it warns us against presuming on tolerance as simply a sort of a positive factor in locating a work or making a decision as to where you're going to start a ministry. Let's say, a neighborhood now Dr. Manny Ortiz from Westminster here lives, in Germantown, where we lived for 12 years. Neighborhood which is now between 85, closer to 90% black. Suppose you start to plant a church in that neighborhood, and the leadership of the church is white. What will happen? Well, my sense is that white planted churches in that neighborhood will attract whites, unless the leadership is black. In other words, churches still grow in the city and in neighborhoods along homogeneous unit lines. And if you don't like the word homogeneous unit, call them neighborhood lines. Second qualification. Remember also, as we talk about tolerance, that there is a substantial degree of variation among American and world cities in the degree of tolerance they possess. San Francisco, for example, here in the United States would be much more tolerant, probably, than Miami or certainly South Boston. In third world cities, tolerance depends on other factors, factors of caste or clan or kinship relations. How deep are these relations? How loose are they? And depending on that, the answers to those questions, tolerance can be very limited. Third point. This last comment we've just made, I think, indicates that urban tolerance results from factors other than urban life itself. Donald McGavern, in his classic, very helpful book, Understanding Church Growth, is generally positive about tolerance as a factor in church growth for the city. Now, I'm referring, when I refer to McGavran's book, to the second edition, which appeared in 1980, I believe. The third edition, which is edited by Peter Wagner, has just appeared from Erdmann's, and unfortunately, they have chosen to eliminate McGavran's chapter on discipling urban populations. So I'm referring to the edition where the chapter on urban population is closed. And in that chapter, on page 282 of my edition, McGavran says this, quote, "Uprooted and transplanted immigrants, starting life anew in strange surroundings, needing community and fellowship, flood into cities. These newcomers are away from the close control of family and the intimates. They are easily reached." End of quote. Now, I think that kind of statement, which is sort of building a model for church growth on this concept of toleration, needs some fairly radical modification. It ignores, I think, certain important details of migration, for example, into the city. Remember, please, immigrants are frequently not that uprooted. Most current urban studies indicate the immigrant retains his or her ties with the home place and with kinship lines. In an excellent book on church growth in Madras that appeared back in 1975, Amitaraj Nelson, for example, points out that in the Madras he researched then, even castes do not often migrate as individuals, they migrate as groups. In other words, they bring their old community with them and they don't break the link. I think this minimizes the argument that emphasized by McGavran of some break with family control. Community, in other words, is not as missing a factor as we believed in the past. Second place, reacting again to some of this, some of McGavran's ideas. Frequently, kin will live in the same area in the new setting. Here in Philadelphia, it doesn't take long to find the Cambodian population. They're living in one particular neighborhood called the Logan area. You'll find Ethiopians scattered not throughout the city, but throughout West Philadelphia. Their frequent interactions, even borrowing of facilities. Large numbers will share the same room or house. One of our students with his child befriended an Ethiopian family, and he found in coming visiting the small room every week, that virtually every week there was a new a member of the community that had come in and somebody else had left. Kinship is strong. Number three, if there are breaks with kin and clan ties, these are more likely among younger people migrating. In other words, tolerance is stronger among the young than the old. The older generation is still deeply tied to the land of their birth and origin. Some have said this is particularly so with Africans and their, in their African context, their self views link themselves personal. They give personal meaning to the land and the hometown. That's very significant. Also, for example, in Korea, one of the first questions you ask in any polite conversation with a Korean is, where is your hometown? You're looking for clan connections when you ask that question. Now, North American and Anglo-Saxon would probably answer that question by telling where he or she is living now. Where's your hometown? I live in I'm from Philadelphia. A Korean would answer where he or she was born, though perhaps the Korean had not lived there since birth. I've met many Koreans who, in answer to that question, will give the name of a city in North Korea, a city which they have not visited for over 30 years. But that is our hometown. So be a little careful about how we don't see tolerance as a possibility in the city, but guard it with a few qualifications. Second area of concern and interest that raised by the Chicago School is the topic of impersonality in the city. Most of these classic theorists we've touched on so briefly feel that impersonality is a very dominant characteristic of the city. Urbanites are pictured as part of a vast, lonely crowd. Remember that book of a few years ago? Anonymous, indifferent to the lives of others around them. And this argument is usually built on some sort of numerical logic. The more people that are in social contact, the greater the impersonality. I suggest that this thesis also has been sometimes picked up in thinking about church growth. One author quoted in the book I mentioned by Amir Taraj Nelson says this, and there's no need to give his name or what page, but I think it's a fairly good sample of how sometimes this is used in evangelical circles. The thesis taken into church growth goes like this, quote, "There are opportunities for accelerated growth in the traditional areas that are becoming modernized and industrialized. It is a fact that the anomie, that is the emptiness, the meaninglessness of the city, the loneliness of the people, contribute to their being winnable," end of quote. Now, as a generalization, once again, I think this has a lot of soundness to it, but once more, a number of cautions, qualifications have to be made, and we need to remember these. Let me mention a few of them. Again, talking about them in connection with the idea of the city as an impersonal thing. Firstly, if primary ties, that is, ties of kin, ties of ethnicity, If these primary ties are strong and retained in the city, loneliness will be minimum. One of the classics of urban sociology, one that changed a great deal of theorizing, was a book written by William White, W-H-Y-T-E, published in 1943, called Street Corner Society. The book is a study, still widely read, of an Italian immigrant area in an Eastern American city. It reveals the existence of strong family, strong neighborhood, strong friendship ties. And in fact, in North American ethnic neighborhoods, such ties appear to be as strong and intimate as any ever uncovered in rural areas. In other words, even North American urbanites are not always the lonely crowd portrayed by Lewis Wirth and others. In fact, it may very well be that the urbanist has moved to the city to find a cure for his or her loneliness. People in high-rises, apartments, condominiums, may not know their neighbors, and they may move into such buildings to maintain personal privacy. But this does not mean that they don't have personal relationships. They just find these in other channels. And connections, their relationships are not built geographically, but very often vocationally or in terms of interests. Job interests, sexual desires. Boy, you've got singles bars, single housing, business associations, all kinds of things become the links that tie one person to another in the city. So as Spates and Massiona say, what seems to be significant about the urban environment is not the lack of ties of attachment, but how these ties vary. That is, cities seem to encourage alternative types of relationships more than other environments do. That's, I think, a valuable insight. In the mid-60s, Harvey Cox published a book called The Secular City, heavy bestseller. And I think he has still one of his finest chapters deals with apartment dwellers, and he provides some real insight into what we're talking about now. He describes a group of ministers who decide to take a survey of urban high-rise apartment dwellers. They were shocked, he says, to learn that these urbanites, whom they expected to be lonely and desperate for relationships, did not want to meet their neighbors socially. In fact, Cox continues, one of the main reasons they had for moving into such apartments in the first place was to escape the relationships forced on them by the lack of anonymity in the village. And the implication is very clear. The city can provide an opportunity for people should they choose to do so. And this maybe this is what Durkheim means by positive freedom. So, even the most private urban dwellers usually have meaningful personal relationships. It's just that the friendships are now shaped not so much by geographical proximity, as in the village or small town. They're shaped by other considerations, people you meet on the job, common recreational interests, etc. The telephone makes extensive contact, urban connections possible, and it didn't do that in the village. Just think for a minute in American life, for example, urban centers. Consider the proliferation in Western culture of voluntary associations. You've got health centers, you've got natural food stores, you've got karate clubs, you've got meditation centers, you've got consciousness-raising groups of all kinds, you've got neighborhood town watches. All these things are centers around which relationships are built, not destroyed. And I think church planting methods must take this into consideration. Too often, we still operate largely from a rural perspective embodied in the concept of the parish. Parish in the sense of Christians living in proximity to one another. Maybe a more functional definition of proximity is necessary for some urban settings. So, churches planted according to personal interest groups. We've had contact in the last 5 or 6 years with one Christian leader whose task is to function as chaplain for tennis players on a world circuit. And he has built, as it were, a mobile church made up of tennis players, no geographical boundaries. We have heard of a growing number of congregations where the vast numbers of the congregation are singles, the church becoming virtually a church of singles. Here in Philadelphia, 10th Presbyterian Church, doors open to everyone, but a church basically made up of professional white-collar workers. Hong Kong, house churches made up of high-rise dwellers. It can happen. Second, still dealing with this idea of impersonality. Remember also that urban neighboring also varies markedly. If you're interested in this further, a little paperback by Suzanne Keller called The Urban Neighborhood, published back in 1968, might be worth taking a look at. Neighborhoods may extend from active, intense relationships, perhaps heavily Roman Catholic neighborhood, to just sort of impersonal nods to somebody you see on the street. Someone driving up, coming home from work, pulling into their driveway. The pattern assumed by neighboring seems to be a matter of group social position. For example, working class neighborhoods are often tighter than those of the upper middle class. Or maybe it's a matter of stages of life. Single people on the move, as it were, typically have much fewer personal ties than families do. Or perhaps it's just personal choice. In other words, the impersonality that Lewis Worth saw in the city as a whole may not really be there as a whole. Herbert Gans, in 1962, wrote a book called The Urban Villagers, and he argued that this characteristic of impersonality is found at best only among the most poverty-stricken and down and out of the city's residents. And this also needs correction. James Spradley did a classic study of the American hobo, followed their life and culture for almost a year, and found deep community lines and a unique subculture forming that linked those hobos together. Still another classic sociological study is Elliot Leboe's Tally's Corner. And it tells the story, it was, I think, a doctoral project initiated by around the life of a small group of men who collected together in front of a local bar called Tally's. And there they shared their lives, found a mutual support, and built a unique subculture, a street corner culture. So, in other words, even a street corner can create a community. And the book, by the way, is well worth getting and reading, still in print. Worth's mistake, in other words, and that of other classic theorists, was to allow the more visible aspects of city life, public demeanor, to become the basis of his theory about living in general. In other words, just summarizing, he was very guilty of generalization from street behavior or the assumptions that he had about small groups within the larger city. He had not examined the private lives of the city citizens. And I'd add here, too, that often as evangelicals have a deep fear of the city, and that fear of the city, that assumption, creates this same propensity to sort of overgeneralization, usually based on while you're driving through a ghetto or a suburb. So let me say something else about this whole question of, again, still speaking of this idea of impersonality. Offering still a third correction to it. These generalizations also assume a certain harmony in rural life that must be questioned. Often, you see, within the village setting, for anybody who's lived in one, there's very deep-rooted conflict and distrust. Oscar Lewis, one of the great anthropologists, the biographical anthropologists of the mid of this century, in 1960 wrote a book called Tepetzlan, Village in Mexico. And he described village life, and it wasn't pleasant, filled with tensions, feuds, interpersonal relations were commonly distrustful. Similarly, too, a village divided by two or three clan kin groups will often display great animosity and severely retard church growth among one clan if the other is becoming Christian. I've seen that many times. Perhaps some of you have as well. The third area that we've talked about, tolerance in the city and impersonality, there is a third area that has flowed or that has circulated around these early classic theoreticians. We won't touch it nearly as much as we have the others, but I think we ought to mention it at least, and that is urban malaise. This sense that often people talk about, that the urban environment creates sort of a mental sickness quicker than the rural area, a loneliness, a depression, anxiety. And really, this hasn't been demonstrated either. In 1973, Claude Fisher, a prominent urbanologist, did a very interesting study on this very topic, published in the journal Social Problems, December 1973. And he found that regardless of the place of residence, whether rural area, village, or city, people seem to demonstrate about the same quality of mental health. In fact, if you believe the writing of Spates and Massionis, pages 53 and 54, if any trend was observed, it was for the city dweller to be more content than the country dweller. And this, as I've just, from the bibliographical reference, these same conclusions reached in a study of Manhattan residents. The city then doesn't create greater psychological distress. City may have more visible problems, but this may simply be due to the fact that it also has more people, and the proportions only appear to be larger. Now, surely also there is more urban malaise. If there is more urban malaise than rural, this is just as antagonistic to church growth as it is positive. An urbanist will be just as indifferent to the church as a rural dweller. and he may just be just as positive as well. So you've got to handle this, however you look at it, with some care. Finally, let me say also one more thing. Reflecting on the, still reflecting on issues that have come out of these early theoreticians, and trying to apply them a little bit to church growth. Finally, something fourthly about the Sidious Gesellschaft. As we've been saying, early urban theorists worried about the ability of people to cope with the city's sheer physical size, its large populations, its anonymity, and all of this was sort of has been capsulized under the rubric of Gesellschaft. And the fear was that people would become automatons. I hope we have in some of the reading you've done already, and certainly our study of the major elements in this theory indicate this is overgeneralization. People as images of God have learned to cope. Our who we are is God's image. This isn't destroyed by the city. We continue to create our own workable model of the city, develop our own mental maps. Why? Because as images of God, we can still deal with the complexities of street behavior. So we continue to create ethical codes of behavior, codes that display both our fallen state, the due to sin, and at the same time our retained sense of imagehood. So we simply create new flexible codes of behavior that deal with sin, and with the heart's retention, even in a fallen state, of who God is and what the world is. And this enables us and everyone else living in cities to shape these social patterns by which our urban experience is structured. And that means we can continue to find a very meaningful urban experience. There are ways of dealing with Gesellschaft. And there are ways of creating meaningful gemeinschaftliche social relationships, even within the city. Our imagehood does not lose its quest for humanity, for sociality outside the garden of some rural Eden. As long as we retain our imagehood, we retain our capacity for personal relationships and a sense of belonging, no matter where God puts us. Now, if you're following along in an outline in front of you now, we're going to make a big jump, and we're going to deal with Roman numeral 3, with anthropological approaches to the city. Up till now, we've been handling the sort of sociological dimensions. Now, we want to touch just a bit on the anthropological shape. And the person who has focused that in many ways, for many people, at least got it off the ground, was Robert Redfield. Not Robert Redford, he makes movies. Robert Redfield, in a real sense, could be called the father of urban anthropology. He was the son-in-law of Robert Park, in fact, a student at the University of Chicago during the period of discussion we've just been describing. Two very strong anthropological biases deeply affected his work. Number one, an evolutionary bias, a deep sense of progress, development. And two, a sort of neo-romantic Rousseauian bias. Out of these things, in Redfield's approach, certain things happen. From the evolutionary bias came the assumptions of progress, the idea of the acceptance of the idea of the unilineal development of or evolution of culture from the simple to the complex. Redfield then imposed that on his view of the city, and on these assumptions, the city then becomes the most evolved, the most progressive form of human culture. Redfield has not been the only one to use an evolutionary schematization to trace the origins or the growth of culture to cities. So Redfield sought to study in his research. He was interested in the development of culture, specifically culture from the primitive to the civilized. And for Redfield, in a real sense, that was development of culture from the rural or the tribal to the urban. In terms of the emerging discipline of urban anthropology, that meant progressive development from tribal to rural to urban. So many of his classic works were written in terms of trying to develop these models. He did a comparative study of a tribe, of a village, of a city in Mexico. Tepetzlan, a Mexican village, appeared in 1930. The Folk Culture of Yucatan, 1941. Peasant Society and Culture, 1956. From his Rousseauian bias, his romanticistic bias, also came a reinforcement of the conclusion that primitive societies were good and urban civilization was bad. This was magnified by the attention of a lot of anthropology in the 1950s to peasant societies, and Redfield's studies pioneered in this area also. His models, though, were basically anti-urban. The pastoral or rural ideal became the model. Tepetzlan, for example, was the first major peasant study by an American anthropologist, and in it, Redfield portrayed the village in very idyllic terms. Throughout this kind of work, he drew constant comparisons between rural and urban. More than one person has made his lists. Let me give you a list as I see them reading Redfield. This is a list, as it were, if you have a paper in your hand, on your left the page you're going to put, on the top of the page you'll put the word rural. On the right hand, the right side of the page, you'll put the word urban. And in these two columns, listen to the contrasts that Redfield underlines in this kind of study. Rural, Gemeinschaft. Urban, Gesellschaft. The one primitive, the other civilized. The one natural and true, the other spurious, superficial, artificial. Rural categories, simple. Urban category, sophisticated. The rural, provincial. The urban, cosmopolitan. The rural, moral. The urban, corrupt. The rural, human in scale. The urban, dehumanized. The one inherently stable. The other inherently changing. The one homogeneous. The other heterogeneous. In the rural patterns, very few alternative modes of behavior. In the urban, many alternative modes. In the rural, focus on the personal. The urban, impersonal, anonymous. The rural, constrained. The urban, free. The rural, integrated. The urban, disintegrated, or enemy. The rural, conformist. The urban, nonconformist. The rural, sacred. The urban, secular. The rural, myth-oriented. The urban rational. You've got quite a list in front of you by now. In his later work, Redfield offered self-corrections to this model. He conceded that a simple dichotomy between folk and urban was an oversimplification, and there were changes. But his early dichotomy remained a very powerful one in urban studies for some time to come, and I fear it still dominates a great deal of evangelical modeling and thinking about the city. Redfield didn't offer these arguments in the community without some criticism. There were many to challenge the Redfield thesis, and I want to, at least at this stage, mention a few who rose to question Redfield's thesis. We're moving into very contemporary studies now, but still very important as urban anthropology began to develop. One of those critics was a man by the name of Gideon Schoberg. That's spelled S-J-O-B-E-R-G. 1960, published a book, The Pre-Industrial City, Past and Present. And he argued that cities are not the same. There are obviously pre-industrial cities and post-industrial cities. And Redfield, the author argued, was implicitly accepting industrial cities as sort of a universal urban model. Schoberg spent a whole book pointing out that pre-industrial cities do not share the characteristics of impersonality and secularism and great size assumed by the folk-urban hypothesis. The point was that Redfield's sort of folk-urban continuum was too heavily pinned to Western industrial cities. Good point was made, and one that has had fairly continued acceptance with some modifications. There was another critic of Redfield. It was Oscar Lewis. In 1952, in the journal The Scientific Monthly, Lewis published an essay, Urbanization Without Breakdown, a Case Study. He drew several comparisons of field data with that of Redfield. In fact, Lewis focused as well some of his own studies, as we'll hear later, on research in the very same city that Redfield had made famous, the city of Tepetzlan. But he drew very different conclusions from his observations. The battle heated up. Redfield had said the city was the source of change. Lewis responded, based on his field data, there are many local sources of change. Redfield had said the rural is homogeneous. Lewis said, hey, the rural is often heterogeneous. Redfield had said any variables in the homogeneity of the rural areas due to urbanization. Lewis responded, many of these variables are independent of urbanization. Redfield had built his work on a rather simple classification of primitive societies. Lewis responded, the classifications are too simplistic. Redfield does not take into account differentiated rates of change, for example. Redfield's work assumes a certain uniform, unilinear evolution of change in all situations of society. Lewis rejected that and argued that that Redfield, as a matter of fact, was too constrained, controlled by this kind of assumption. Primitive societies, he said, were quite varied in the form of organization. The differences were sharp. Really, in a sense, since Redfield's work, not one critic has yet worked out an adequate substitute to Redfield's with equal appeal. The bipolar models has its problems, as we're trying to argue. It stereotypes, camouflages urban reality by oversimplification. But the model did serve and still does serve to deal with some issues rather well. It explains change, directionality. And any model, whatever one we come up with, must take these into account. And this also, I think, has implications for mission strategy. It's important that we see the city as not bad per se, or not good per se. It just underlines the need for strategy in urban missions, and that's what's still, I think, lacking. I want to mention, we've talked about Redfield and we've mentioned his critics. I want to mention a third name before we move on to the next part of our discussions. And that third name, in one sense, is not so much an anthropologist as a sociologist, but his work has had tremendous impact. We're speaking of W. Lloyd Warner. It was Warner, say more than one scholar, who offered urban anthropology the one of a major alternative to Redfield's work. Warner had begun his career with a study of Australian Aborigines, and then he decided to use the same methods on a study of the North American city. The result of this research was a series of volumes referred to as the Yankee City series. The focus of his work was Newport, Massachusetts, and specifically Newport, Massachusetts from 1930 to 1935. Warner's book really was part of a movement providing strong interest in communities in the United States. And I think out of part of this flow, part of this new interest, saw a number of books developing in this same direction. I've mentioned, for example, already the book by William White, Street Corner Society, Herbert Gans's study, The Urban Villagers, and later in 1967, very interesting research called The Levitt Towners, a study of life in suburbs built by William Levitt, Elliot Leboe's classic Tally's Corner. All these things were stimulated by Warner's focus. Warner, in doing his work, focused on the study of classes and hierarchies. And it's a massive piece of work. Obviously, we can't go into it now. But I think Warner had a strong part in putting the whole question of class and social class and hierarchies of social class on the urban anthropological agenda. In doing his research, he measured these hierarchies culturally, financially, comparing them in terms of occupations, comparing them even in terms of things like the magazines they read, the clubs they belonged to, even the churches they attended. And he found a striking layering of these kinds of things. Just to give you one example, with each of the groups, he upper class, middle class, lower class, these again were subdivided. So, for example, the upper class, two subdivisions. There was the upper class and the lower upper class. And similarly for the middle class, there were upper middle class, lower middle class, same for the lower class. With the upper class, thinking just, for example, if you had a column in front of you and you labeled this, now you put your six classes on the left of the paper, upper, lower, etc. And now you're dividing your paper according to occupations. What kind of occupation would you find, says Warner, in terms of his research? What would you pencil in under occupation for the upper class? Warner responds, independently wealthy. Still dealing with the upper class, but now the lower upper class. What would you find? Well, you'd find new wealth. Now we move down our column and we come to the middle class, and specifically the upper middle class. Well, in this category, we're going to find probably the professionals. We move down our column, still with the middle class, now the lower middle class. What will we find? Well, perhaps Warner says lower white collar, professional people. And we step down again, the lower class and the upper lower, blue collar workers. What about the bottom, the lower class? Those who are on welfare, those who work on the basis of hourly wage. You can break down these categories as well, even in terms of the denominations that people attend and the classes often associated with denominations. Richard Niebuhr did a fascinating study of this called The Social Sources of American Denominations. And I think overlapping a lot of Warner studies. Well, Warner moved the world to do some thinking, but he had his problems, and critiques began to be offered, problems arising, critiques of the problems associated with Warner's study of social hierarchies. I'll mention just a couple, two or three of them, and we're going to do this very quickly. Warner's hierarchies makes a very sharp boundary between all the classes. And anthropologists since then have noted such boundaries are often too sharp. The classes instead are rather a continuum with a lot of movement upward on the continuum. And the second criticism, there's often a static character to the divisions. Warner's theory provides very little room for mobility, whether you're going up or down. And thirdly and last, Warner's studies were severely limited to one city or town. And as a result, there is little comparison between one city or town and another city or town. And this, in turn, allows for very little work in the macro study area. Warner says some offers no real help for the study of national-level hierarchies. Now, what does all this say for missiology and any observations we'd want to make about church planning as we sort of think through Warner and this new direction? Well, I'll just give you a couple of suggestions and then we'll be closing off our discussion at this point. I think, first of all, we need to be aware of class differences in determining how people will be reached for Christ. Here in Philadelphia, we have some fine churches, and they're all different, and they're all fine. 10th Presbyterian Church, Bach Preludes, people encouraged to be quiet when they go inside for worship, structured, ordered service, excellent Bible teaching. Too far away on the edge of Philadelphia is another church, New Life Presbyterian Church. The structure there very different. Music, no Bach preludes there. Lots of noise, people in jeans, cutoffs. Enthusiasm shared, very different styles. Those styles are not simply theological, they are class differences. Think also, practically speaking, we need to be aware of the effects of mobility, of the tendency of churches to rise in the social order over longer periods of time. Warner's study, as we mentioned, was felt to be too static. More recent research is recognizing, hey, there's real mobility here. So it seems to me also pretty fair to say that an awful lot of churches are born in the upper lower class and in the lower middle class. And then they move up. And as they move up into other classes, they gradually lose their ability to evangelize their peers. I think in part this is due to the continued use of methods of evangelism that work in the lower classes. And what they need to do, and often don't realize it, is to find methods that work at the upper levels of society. This also, I think, affects our choice of where to start churches. Do we start churches in the inner city or in suburbs in the United States? Suburban churches may start in the city with blacks who migrate, but they will find that their shape, their lifestyle has changed as they move to suburbs. Where should we plant Hispanic churches? Start in the suburbs? No, you start in the inner city. And also you plant churches in the suburbs. But since suburbanites often tend to be more resistant to the gospel, if a choice is to be made, start in the inner city. Let the church move in upward mobility with the people. Planning suburban churches in order to reach the city will rarely work, because mobility among ethnics and human social classes is always upward, not downward. You don't go back, you go forward. Well, these are a few hints. We'll let them go till we begin again.